Session number 9797.
Mr. Spearman, reel 4.
Yes, but not put out. Once they got resettled in the new villages, they got lookout posts built around on the four corners of the perimeter. They developed their own home guard, which changed throughout the night to prevent the terrorists coming down. But of course, every day, all the forest workers, all the rubber tappers, all the cultivators, all had to leave the camp. And every one of them who was contacted by terrorists on their outlying places of work were told, and no certainty where they stopped bringing food. They had to bring some food, even if it was a handful of rice, every day. So this is what then happened. They actually forced them by fear to bring out this rice. Young children used to take out rice, the mothers used to take out rice. Even though they were bodily searched, they found the most devious way of getting rice past them. But it did do a lot of good. It did make it far more difficult for these bandits then, you know, to live so easily off these outlying places as they did previously. So it was a good scheme. It wasn't a very happy scheme, resettling people forcibly into homes. I mean, they're doing this in South Africa for a different reason, and everybody objects to it strongly. There was a reason for it here, and in a way it did pay off. Anyway, it was about this time. I mean, there's all sorts of things happened which I can't recall, all sorts of interesting things which would make it very interesting if I had time or could really think about it more. But it was about this time, early in 1950, about May in 1950, that Briggs sent a telegram round to all the officers commanding police district that if they had any police lieutenants who could speak the language, who had jungle operation were well liked and various things, then they had to be posted down to Johor, and I was one. I got a telegram one day saying I had to go down to Johor, and I got posted to as a field force commander and posted to Johor, and immediately I was posted with this ready-made field force squad and sent to a place called Chamek, Chamek, Chamek village in Johor, which was a hotbed of communism. It was really a hotbed of communism. And I think the reason I was sent there is because my history of Malaya, for self-reliability, for self-motivation, for meeting and killing the bandits and this sort of thing, suited me for that type of job. I suppose this is the way they theorised. And a lot of the rubber planters, very important industry, rubber planting, a lot of rubber planters were being attacked. And this village of Chamek was actually pronounced to be the hotbed, the centre of this communist cell that were down in Johor, and I was actually posted to this bloody village, and it was, the village lay astride the main railway line from Singapore right up to Pier up in the north, you know, so it was on a mainline railway line, and every week this train, the slow local train, used to get ambushed, you know, by the bandits. It was a terrible bloody place, which I found, much to my horror, but I don't know how long I was there, but I was there long enough to have have various horrifying experiences. Being a very friendly person, one of my things I think I was good at was making friends with people, whether they were Chinese, Malays or Indian or whatever they were. But I came across there, a lot of these, they were right under the thumb of communism. It was an isolated village. I don't think there was any road approach to it. I can't remember why. I never went out of it on a road. I think it must have been just on a railway. There was a police station there, which I took my squad into. There were only a couple of policemen there. There had been various number of policemen killed. The police station had been attacked a number of times. So we became, with this new field force, this new squad of Malays, I had quite a job. I used to patrol, and they're all lazy. They got in the habit. They'd been with somebody who hadn't pushed them. So I had problems on that side. And then I had to more or less take this village to pieces. I spent night and day on the village, you know, around the village, trying to catch people going out of the village and this sort of thing. And I got one or two of the chief people in the village who had a bit of influence on my side, and they formed an association called MCP. It wasn't members of the Communist Party, it was the Malayan something party anyway. It was a very good thing they started this association, because we began to get two sides of it there. But I had a hell of a difficulty in that area sorting out these people in the village. And then it came to my patrolling things. I had a number of rubber planters in the area, all were demanding that I should go up and check around their estate, because they felt there were bandits living there. And they were. We found a couple of always found places where bandits had been recently. The bandits were aware that we'd arrived on there, one because of our patrolling activity, and they lay low for a couple of months, and they found we weren't going, so they decided they would draw us into a situation and ambush us. And this is what happened this particular day. I can't remember how we got messages. Somebody come rushing in to say somebody had been killed down there in this particular area, you know, on this, beyond this rubber plantation. So immediately, I mean, this was the first thing that happened on our doorstep since I've been there. So I had the squad on call and immediately assembled the squad and went rushing out there. You never rush too far when there's an ambush on you. You have to be really careful. You half expect that it's maybe nothing there at all. It's false information. It's just to get you into an area. But they would kill somebody just to get you to go out to the area and ambush you halfway there, you know. And on this occasion, we got to this place where these people had been killed, and we went on a bit further. All took time to do it, but eventually we came to a certain place where there was a bit of a swamp between us, and then there was a hill the other side. And the hill, they had about 100 bandits on this hill. And as we came round this corner, across this swamp area, they were all over there, and we were all over here, wide open to their view. It was a sort of the end of a sort of a rubber estate, and there were no jungle trees around, and there wasn't all that much cover either, you know. And as soon as we got in that position, they opened up fire, and then they started moving down the hill as though they were going to attack us. You know, I was really worried about this because it was unheard of for them to attack you, you know. We couldn't attack them because there was more of them than there was us. I had about 20 people, you know. And I said to the brain gunner, you know, get cracking, because there's your target, you can see them, you know. So he didn't seem to be knocking anybody over. I would say it was a range of 300 yards. And when I got his brain gunner, he hadn't set the bloody rangefinder to, you know, he just saw the bandit start opening up, firing away, taking accurate aim, but if the rangefinder wasn't right, the bullets weren't reaching. So I took over the brain gun in order to get some satisfaction. And I saw certain people in there when they were firing, getting right on the target where the dust burst up, you know, kept their head down, and eventually, thank heavens, they sort of dispersed. And I only had one chap who got wounded. You know, it could have been a lot worse, because I'm sure they intended to attack us, you know, but we were quite well armed.
So it was an ambush, really, led by them?
It wasn't a proper ambush, because an ambush, really, is done on a very bendy road, as I've said before, where they chop a tree down and a car runs into it, or you pull up when you see the tree, and then you're in the killing ground, whoever's in it gets killed, because the guns open up, your preset position shoot up on you. But this was a sort of an ambush. They'd kill these people, and normally they would disappear then into the jungle, but they didn't disappear here. They just drew back to this nice little hill thing from where I couldn't get to them. It was all swamp in between, and I couldn't easily have got across there, even if I'd have had the courage or enough men to do it. And they were, you know, so anyway.
When would that have been, do you know?
Well, the only note I got from my photographs here, that I was posted at Chami Village, I've got here, May 1950. This is about the time. And then my next note here, yes, that was a type of an ambush where they kill people to draw the new person there into the air. I was making a nuisance of myself. Villagers are saying, I can't do it now, we're under strict supervision and this sort of thing. So they wanted to stir it up, and this is the way they were doing it. Another little incident there, I mean, I had a lot of skirmishes in this place. I don't want to dwell here too long because there's a lot more to say, but we had a lot of skirmishes there, but that was the most serious big incident with 100 bandits, where we could have gotten into serious trouble if they'd have had a little bit more intelligence. And it was about that time there where I was in touch with all the planters, but this particular planter was looking for a typewriter, and for some reason I had a portable typewriter with me. I always had this portable typewriter with me. I never talk on jungle patrol, of course, but I always had it when I was static somewhere, like I was here in Chami. And I said, well, I'll sell you mine, bugger. I don't use it. I don't really want it. So he came down this night to buy the typewriter. And when he got there, we had a couple of whiskies. He said, I can't give you all the money. He said, I'll give you a cheque for half and cash for the other. Bearing in mind, those years ago, you know, money didn't mean the same as it did now, you know. So whatever he was paying me for the second-hand typewriter, he gave me half in cash and half in cheque, right? And we had a few more wishes on the strength of having done a deal, and by the time he went to go back to his estate, it was rather late at night, and he was worried about an ambush, quite right. So he got so drunk he really couldn't go back. He was driving. So he stayed the night. He got up at 5:30 next morning, and I saw him off at 5:30, 6:15. He'd only been gone about 5 minutes, and this bloody tremendous shooting home that he'd run right into an ambush. So they'd seen him come down from his plantation the night before, and must have stayed there all night waiting for him to come back. This is how they operated. It was most dangerous for these planters. And of course, some of the shooting happened, I knew exactly what had happened. He was obviously at an ambush. It all came together. So then I had to get the squad out. It took me 10 minutes to get everybody out. And we had no transport to go on this. It was you can drive through a rubber plantation, but we had no transport, I don't think. We went by foot, so it took us half an hour to get there. And by this time, the bandits had gone, but the car was aflame. And I thought, Christ, I forget his name. I thought it was that fellow you'd mentioned before, but I really don't remember his name. Anyway, what had happened, when he came under fire, this fellow, it was an ambush. It wasn't an ambush on a bend, it was on a straight road for some reason. They must have been in the side of the road, and it was a straight road, and there was no way he could escape. He couldn't drive off because there were big ditches on either side, monsoon ditches, you know, through this rubber estate. But anyway, he'd managed to get out of the car on the blind side and made his way wounded, he got badly wounded, into some bit of cover there. And he survived the ambush, and we took him away. But inside the car, there was my typewriter on the back seat, with all the back seat burned to cinder, but the typewriter just sort of scorched. It survived. So I got my typewriter back and got him taken to hospital on the train. And I sent word to him. He went into hospital, and I went to see him in hospital. That's right. I went down to Johor and went to see him in hospital, and I gave him his money and his cheque back in the hospital. I said, you won't want to be bothered, because he had to go to the UK or somewhere with his wound, the bad wound he had. So I gave him his money back, and he's saying, I've still got the very typewriter. In fact, I've just given it to my daughter. Not much good now.
Do you know the date of that ambush?
No, I don't. I don't, but it was... I've got a note here. I can only get these from my photographs. It must have been around... I know in April 1950 Briggs came, because I've got a telegram upstairs which says that I had to move. So I'm orientated in the right area. So I think it must have been out May 1950, and it's Chami Village. When I left there, all these Chinese citizens in this village took a big photograph of me in their midst, seated in seats in front of the village hall. Only a small village, only as big as this garden, no, a bit bigger than that. And they gave me this presentation letter, wished me all good health in my retirement from Malaya. I was coming up due for holiday at the time, and they thought they put it in the letter. I'm sure you're retiring, you know, so that was Chami. And then in the October of 1951, I think I must have gone to Holi about that time, October 1951, Sir Henry Gurney, the commissioner who was appointed from Palestine, he got killed in an ambush, and that was a big knock. And the second big knock to the whole thing, in the next month after the ambush, was that Briggs, Sir Harold Briggs, who'd made this Briggs plan, which had organised these new villages and the idea of driving away, cut away from the population and drive them into the jungle, had worked very well. But he'd had a lot of frustration liaising the civilian people with the military people. Nobody wanted to cooperate in any way. Every time he gave one direction, they always complained to him that it wasn't fair, that they should be doing it and not the other people. He never succeeded in bringing them together. Great difficulty, because some of these colonial people have been in the civilian administration out there, or the police administration, been there all their lives. They were very bloody stubborn, you know, and him coming from another part of the country, he was unhappy. The only reason I know that, you read it, Sir Gerald Templer wrote a book about Sir Gerald Templer called The Tiger of Malaya. He didn't know much about it, but he did a wonderful job. He was the next thing, I'm going on to say. So he left in frustration. So there we'd lost a Gurney ambush, and in the next month Briggs went. At the end of his term, he'd been there a year, I suppose. No, he'd been there 3 years, and that was him going, a three-year term. So he pulled out, and Gurney had been killed. But then in 19 February 52, they've been spending a long time looking for somebody, a warlord, an over-everybody warlord. And they appointed this fellow, Sir Gerald Templer. And he was an overall warlord, and he made a dynamic impact on Malaya, immediately arrived. He had absolute power over everybody in Malaya, even including the rulers of every state. There were Malayan rulers in every state. who you could never cross, but he had authority as a warlord to dictate to anybody, and he demanded when he arrived the cooperation of all Malay peoples of whatever race they were. He demanded it. I can't interrupt. I demanded. Yes, he demanded. He demanded the cooperation of everybody in Malaya. Now, to be fair to Briggs and anybody who went before him, there was nobody who were given this overall authority to dictate to anybody. So he came there with all that authority, determination and background, and everybody was with him. If anybody said a word against it, one copper immediately was sent out of the country, you know, as far as British people were concerned. And he used to go into little villages like Sunny Seaport, walk around himself with a suitable guard, and say to the chief of the village or whatever it was, and all the chiefs he'd bring around, he said, "I want information for you within 48 hours. If you don't give me information within 48 hours about the terrorists, I'm going to move the village." He was ruthless with everybody. Nobody else could have done that before, because you can't just move villages like that. But he had the authority to do it, and he wielded this authority. And when he came across people, English people, in the civilian or the military or the police organisations who didn't jump, do and tell him what he did or objected to anybody, he went mad. He used to swear, virtually swear. And he would tolerate no excuses for anything. And he started a campaign to win the hearts and minds of all the people in Malaya. This is what the operation was called, the hearts and mind. And he stopped at nothing to get his way. But they knew what they had to do, and he was going to do it, and nobody was going to stop it. When he was told by the special branch, say for instance, these lived under the thumb of the terrorists and they wouldn't give you information, that's what he used to do. He used to go there, get them together, and he said, "I want it within 48 hours. If he said, "I don't get it," he said, "that's you finished." And it worked. You know, sheer brutal government ruling, you know, and it was one of the big things in Malaya. He really stirred things up. Anyway, I eventually went on holiday, and I came back and I got posted then as an instructor to the police depot in Kuala Lumpur. It wasn't particularly a suitable posting, but we were training people on jungle work and on weapon training and things like this. So it was an interlude. I bought myself a motorbike at that period. But anyway, with this Templar thing getting underway and the emergency beginning to make steps, I volunteered to go on an operational helicopter course, and it was the use of helicopters in the jungle. This was a new thing now, which was beginning to develop, you know. We use helicopters a lot, but this course was specifically in a place called Dusuntur. It was specifically made...
Called what?
Dusuntur, the name of the place.
How do you spell it?
Dusuntura. It was a helicopter course where you dynamited trees down just to make landing pads for the helicopter to come down. You'd make a clearing in the jungle with explosives, if you had explosives, and fell the trees and make a sort of a raised platform for the helicopter to come down to, you know. I've got a photograph of the people on the course. I can't remember a great deal about the course, except that we learnt all about what helicopters needed in the way of a landing zone and takeoff zone and things like this. And then as soon as I finished that helicopter course, I was asked to go into the jungle and open up a fort in the Negeri Sembilan area of southern Malaya. And this was the communist headquarters of the Southern Communist Party or something, I forget exactly what it was, but the fort was called Iskander, Fort Iskander. And the idea of the fort was to go in there, make friends with the Aborigine tribes, because after the bandits, and before then, after the bandits had been chased away from the main populated areas of Malaya, they then went into the deeper jungle and went to these Aboriginal tribes and said, "Look, we're the government, we want you to grow food for us." So this is what happened. All the Aborigines in the jungle started growing food for these Chinese communists who'd been around in the jungle all for about 6 or 7 years by this time, more, because they were there, they knew how to live in the jungle. They knew how to grow their own food, but why grow it themselves? Why didn't they get the Aborigines to do it for them? And there was no way the Aborigines could tell they weren't the government. So our job was to go in amongst all this and put up forts areas around which we can bring all the Aborigine tribes and settle them within the distance of the fort, and thereby give them security and stop them working with the, for the bandits. And this was what I went to Fort Iskander to do.
Where was this Fort Iskander?
In Negra Sembilan, in the middle of Malaya. A place called Negra Sembilan. It was actually in a place in the jungle known as the Tasik Brur.
What?
Tasik Brur, big lake district, big swamp area.
How do you spell it?
T-A-S-E-K-B-E-R-A. Tasik Brur. And there's a book written by one of the survivors, one of the English survivors, of the occupational time when the Japanese were there, called, a chap called Spencer Chapman. He wrote a book called The Jungle is Neutral. And if you want to get into Malaya and learn about jungle, do yourself a favour and get that book. He's dead now, committed suicide, unfortunately. But if you can read his book and read every line of it, you realise what it's like living in the jungle. And how these communists, even though he's dead against them, how he made, you know, he got malaria and he was out completely for a couple of weeks, and the communists looked after him. Chen Peng, this big communist, he looked after him. He became very friendly with him. And if it hadn't been for these Chinese, he doesn't think he could have survived. But he had a tremendous character and a tremendous will to live, Spencer Chapman. The most marvellous book, you should read it if you ever have your interest in it. It's a dang good book. And he refers to this Tasik Brur. He reckons he was the first Englishman, first European ever to get his step foot in that area. So it was really a very deep, deep jungle area, you know. And you asked me where it was. It was a place called the Tasik Brur. And if you look at Malaya on a map, it's right in the middle of Malaya on the border of Selangor and Pahang. That's where it was. And you used to march into it. It took a couple of days to go into it if you knew the way. And it was a complete swamp area. Now, jungle trees can be 100, 150, 2 feet high. And so when you got the maps of the area, when you were posted to this sort of operation, you were given the ordnance maps. And these are absolutely useless in that area. This is one reason, I think, why any military had no success in the area, because every time they got somewhere, the swamps came up and they got isolated and they had to go away. The swamp came up and down, and huge trees 100 feet high used to disappear. You'd come and take an aerial photograph 1 month and you'd see all the trees. You'd come another month, there'd be nothing there. It looked like a huge lake. It used to go up and down like that. It was a fantastically lovely place as far as I was concerned, because for the first time I started mixing with the Aborigines. And where I said that the Malays were good because they could track and, you know, it was their environment, they were like city people compared with Aborigines, who'd never lived outside in civilised places at all. The tribe dominating the area was a tribe called the Semelai tribe, S-E-M-E-L-I-A, Semelai. And there was another tribe there, beginning with a T, Temelai, I think it were, Temelai, who I was told to contact, and civilised as it were. And even though I'd seen them, shadows of them in the jungle, or found little places where one or two of them had been the night before, I never did actually make contact with them. And I was there for 2.5 years. I never made contact with them. But the Semelai tribe, straight away I made contact with. It's difficult. They run away from you. It's hard to catch them. But we eventually caught them. And, of course, they didn't even speak Malay.
What do you mean you caught them?
Well, I caught up with them, where they didn't run away. Where the Malays are very nice people. They're not aggressive in any way like that. These Aborigines, when they see a white man at that time, I mean, when Spencer Chapman went in there during time, he thinks he was the first European ever been to that area. So we were certainly one of the few Europeans they'd seen since then, you know what I mean? They hadn't seen many, although there were directors running the Aborigine welfare and things like that, who they knew about. But when they caught them and when they civilised them, but if they're not static, if they're nomads like the other tribe were, it's very hard to get hold of them. But when you eventually catch up with them and talk to them and make friends with them, and then say, like, what we had to say to them, right, we're going to take you away from the village where you're living now, we're going to bring you down here and you're going to live on that place over there, or is there another place here you prefer? We brought them all within 1 mile of the fort. There were 6 villages, I think. We moved them all, voluntarily. We got them to do it. There were certain things we tempted them with, you know. There was one camp I'm going to remember called Rengut, camp on Rengut, R-E-N-G-U-T, which was a little bit further up in this swamp, which was too far away to what it should be. And when the High Commissioner came into the fort to see me, he did, in a letter afterwards, saying that he hoped I would be able to move this one particular kampong within the fort perimeter, because he felt, you know, that it would be better for the people if they were in. But I particularly didn't want to move that village at that time, because they were isolated a little bit from the fort, and I had a few friends in there who would definitely give me information when the terrorists came in the area, so in a way they could be an asset to me. But if I can describe this Tasik Brer area, it was large, like a large swampland lake, and it would take you all day long in a boat, in a prayer, to paddle from one end to the other. And in low water, the channel amongst all the deep reeds would often go very near the land, where the land jutted out, these waterways amongst the reeds. They were well above your head. You moved along silently, but sometimes they would make contact with the shore. So there were, when the water was low, there was the danger of ambush, being in a boat, and you suddenly come round with these tall reeds, they disappear because there's a little inlet there, and then the land. You're in a very dangerous situation there, which you try to avoid. If you could, you'd find another way through, because it was only swamp. It was deep swamp. Anyway, I eventually got all these samurai all brought within a mile of the fort, and my job then was to get information from them. First of all, I built an airstrip there for Osters to come in, and for the big Lysanders to drop in parachute drops on this little aerodrome that we built. All we did was cut down the trees, got the paid the samurai with rice, with food, to cut away these trees and to clear this area where an Oster could come down. He just had room to come down and pull up, and then again to come in and take off. Of course, helicopters could come in easily. So that earned them a lot of money, and this made friends with them, because they brought all the families there, they brought all the dogs there. We became very friendly. They spoke the Semmelai language. I wasn't going to learn how to speak Semmelai. I did start, but I thought it was silly. All the people I had with me were Malays. The right thing to do was to develop their Malay, which they couldn't speak to start with. I mean, they could speak a few words. Certain things are common words, you know. So this is what we had to do. So we started a school, paid them to put up a big bamboo school building, you know, got all the children in, the fathers used to come in if they were, and we used to start teaching them Malay and then start teaching them English, you know, what English they could teach them. That was one thing we did. And the other thing was I formed a home guard. I got volunteers, just the same way as I did with the Malays when I went over there first, to get an armed force of Aborigines. I needed them, you know. I always had a field force in there with another European who used to come in every 2 weeks. They changed every 2 weeks, and I used to tell them what they had to do, this sort of thing. I was on overall command of anybody who came into the fort, whether it was soldiers or police, you know. But I had my own people, and I really learnt to use them in the right way, because the jungle is so easy to get lost in. In Pier, I got lost a number of times, and that wasn't really, it was always within a day of the main road, and in that way it isn't quite so easy to get lost. But when you get right down the middle spine of Malaya,